Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, a letter signed by tens of thousands of artists in the aftermath of George Floyd's killing sought changes to help theatrical artists of color. We'll look at what, if anything, has changed since. We have a report on the Trump administration cutting several programs that help disadvantaged students. There's an effort to clean up the Ohio River, but it needs help from Congress. An update is ahead. We'll continue our look at high-speed rail and what the future may hold for this mode of transportation in Illinois. We'll begin a series on prison education as we talk with three incarcerated men at one state institution. And just how big of a deal are pumpkins, which make their way into different dishes this time of year? We visit one central Illinois town where it is a cash crop. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Within weeks of the release of a video showing Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin kneeling on the neck of George Floyd, an open letter from Chicago theater artists titled We See You, White American Theater, emerged. The letter, which has now been signed by 100,000 artists, put a spotlight on those who feel unseen and undervalued, and it sought an end to the tokenizing of people of color in the industry. 5 years after the letter, reporter Mike Davis set out to learn what, if anything, has changed.
I set out asking a question that I was afraid I already knew the answer to. Did the We See You White American Theater movement ever stand a chance? And 5 years later, have any theater artists here in Chicago seen a change? To get to the bottom of this, I asked a bunch of artists. I started with a seasoned theater vet. Lillianne Brown is a Chicago-based director. She's a Southside native, Northwestern alum. She started her career as an actor, co-founded a successful theater company in the early aughts, and is now one of the prominent directors in the local scene. She recently staged The Color Purple at the Goodman.
Needs a needle and a spool of thread. Got about a million patterns in my head.
She was an early signer of the movement's statement.
The premise of it, I thought, was correct, and that something did need to be said about just the state of theater. I didn't read any, like, I don't even know if there was like 100 bullet points or whatever at first. There was just a statement. And the statement was something that I, you know, understood.
Actor A.J. McGee has toured with a Broadway show. He's also been on the biggest stages in Chicago. Currently, he has a lead role in Revolutions at the Goodman.
Everything that was going on in 2020 was in response to police killing with impunity. I felt like that was the conversation. And I love theater, and I love theater people. But I know we get sort of insular sometimes in our theater world.
McGee said in his career, the roles available now are the same roles he was getting before George Floyd's murder and before the theater community's letter. He said he's either singing, dancing, or playing a prisoner.
The reality is we got to sell these tickets. We got to sell these tickets, and black people, if they're not singing, don't sell. And I don't think anybody wants to say that because they're racist and do not care about black humanity.
Award-winning playwright and actor Terry Guest was a newcomer to Chicago when the statement made its rounds. Guest reflects on the changes in the years after the letter.
I feel like the industry has made several changes. I think that there was obviously a huge change in the 2020, 2021, 2022 seasons. And I think that a lot of young artists of color, myself included, really got a lot of opportunities to tell our stories that we were not getting the year before. And I think that a change is happening again. And I think a lot of those opportunities are drying up.
Guest is describing the shift being felt by theater artists throughout the city. In 2021, as theaters reopened, there was an intentional effort to support creatives of color through DEI initiatives. Now, the Trump administration has rolled back funding for the arts and pulled back promised funds to organizations and artists that he deems focus on DEI or gender identity. Brown, however, has experienced things a little bit differently. She's built a reputation among Black actors for being one of a handful of directors who frequently provides them with work. The aftermath of the letter may have contributed to her rise in the industry.
You know, I'll never really know why my career, like, shot up the way it did, because it happened at a strange time, right? Was it already happening? Yeah, there was definitely already something happening. Had the pandemic not happened and so much protest in 2020 not happened, would my career be like it is now? I actually am not, I don't know. It was a really crazy time that year. So there was a lot of scrambling, and I think I definitely, in a strange way, may have benefited from people scrambling to have the right optics.
Kevin Awosu is an up-and-comer in Chicago theater. He's the founder of Local Lab Collective and an associate director at Steel Point Theater. He doesn't believe things have changed for creatives in Chicago.
I can still be in a room and look around at all the designers, and all the designers are white. I still, especially in Chicago, I see casting notices that go out being like actors of color, BIPOC. And then when the casting list comes out, it's white. These, because for We See You White American Theater, it felt like such a cry out to the big organizations, the big theaters. If the smaller theaters aren't able to live by these rules and these expectations that we want to hold the larger theaters to, then how are we actually making change happen? Because unfortunately, it, you know, there's trickle down economics, but it's trickle up change.
In the end, I got the answer I expected. For Black theater artists, the letter didn't lead to significant change. But just because the industry as a whole hasn't shifted, doesn't mean the needle hasn't budged at all. Lillianne Brown said,
awareness has changed. And I think honestly, that's kind of the point of making any initial statement, is the first thing you have to do is raise awareness. It's naive to think that people in a bubble understand what is going on outside of that bubble. So the first thing you have to do is make people aware.
Mike Davis, WBEZ News.
The Trump administration cut several TRIO programs in Illinois meant to support disadvantaged students. Peter Medlin reports on what that means.
A few years ago, Sam Sutton moved from California to Illinois and enrolled at Elgin Community College. She was homeschooled her whole life, which made the social part of school difficult, especially in a new place, away from family, and she was financially unstable after the move, which made it daunting just to enroll. Her grades were pretty good, but she didn't feel connected.
When I would struggle on an assignment, I wouldn't ask my teachers for help. I would just like suck it up and ask the internet.
Then her art club advisor told her about TRIO Student Support Services, known as SSS. It's one of 8 federal TRIO programs and one of 3 offered at Elgin Community College. TRIO is funded by the U.S. Department of Education, particularly for low-income, first-generation, and students with disabilities. And SSS provides one-on-one counseling, tutoring, and other assistance. Soon, Sutton's art club advisor became her TRIO coordinator, which she says helped her blossom as a student.
She actually went with me to talk to my professor. She was there making sure that not only was I feeling supported and I had somebody to turn to, but to make sure I knew what questions to ask.
But Sutton says TRIO has helped her with much more than just academics.
Moving out here away from my family, I obviously didn't have a job and I was not financially stable. They put me in connection with the food pantry we have here on campus and they helped me find jobs.
Natalie Leistering says that's how TRIO's supposed to work. She's Elgin Community College's Associate Dean of Student Success.
When students have those one-on-one meetings with a student support person, they're more likely to succeed than someone that doesn't.
That's backed up by federal data. In 2019, during the first Trump administration, the Department of Education released a study on TRIO student support services, and it found that SSS students at four-year schools were 18% more likely to complete a degree than similar students who weren't in the program. And at community colleges like Elgin, the difference was even more significant. Students like Sutton at two-year schools were 48% more likely to earn a degree, certificate, or transfer to a four-year school. The nonprofit Council for Opportunity in Education supports and advocates for TRIO, and a spokesperson told WNIJ that this year, the Trump administration has cut over 100 TRIO programs across the country, with more than 40,000 students no longer receiving services. Here in Illinois, the administration has canceled three programs, which represents over $1 million in grants and more than 1,000 students no longer receiving TRIO services. The spokesperson says they could not disclose which Illinois institutions had programs canceled, but that the canceled TRIO grants all had diversity-related goals or efforts. Elgin Community College has not had its grant cut. Associate Dean Leistring says their TRIO SSS still serves 362 students. But remember, TRIO is not just student support services. Michelle Ramirez runs Elgin's SSS program and says their college offers two other TRIO programs that serve another 634 students.
We have TRIO Upward Bound. It's designed to help high school students gain skills and succeed in high school and college. And then we have TRIO Talent Search Transitions, and it's designed to help middle schools and high school students to graduate high school.
Sam Sutton says that TRIO has changed her life.
Originally, I was just going to do the two-year degree and go into the workforce. But with the help of TRIO, I have a lot of scholarship opportunities.
She says they've helped her apply for scholarships, align transfer credits, and organize campus visits to shop around for the right four-year school. She says TRIO deserves a lot of credit for her success, and she's become a sort of unofficial ambassador.
I carry their business cards in my wallet and in my backpack. Yes, I will give them out.
She says that federal cuts at other schools are really disappointing.
It's just so heartbreaking. Everybody should have the opportunity we have here. I'm a great student because of it, so.
President Trump's 2026 budget proposal calls for eliminating TRIO completely. I'm Peter Medlin.
Mentorship is a critical part of life for people in prison, and it helps the incarcerated provide support to one another. The Danville Correctional Center has led Illinois in encouraging those kinds of relationships with formal group classes. The curricula range from conflict resolution to parenting to budgeting for life after prison. As part of a series on prison education, Emily Hayes spoke with three men there about how that program is going.
I'm Larry McCaskill. I've been a part of the program since 2018.
Being in these groups where you hear yourself say these things that you don't say out loud, right? These harsh realities, these black and white absolutes that you think make sense, right? And then you hear other people's truths. And more than anything, I started to understand how unhappy I was, because my life was, it felt like I had no agency, no power. Like everything was already preordained. If you do this, I have to say this. I have to do this, right? And I had no choice. And so for me, the beginning experiences were liberating, because it was like, wait. I have cornered myself off in life where there are entire regions of my personality I have never tapped into. Anyone who knows me, like, I am like comic book reading, anime watching, Marvel obsessed nerd. And I thought I was this hardcore, like, hardcore, fully committed to like this one life. And so when you come to a place like Danville, when there's so much movement, and you come to the building block and there's so many personalities and there's so many different things to experience, right? So many different perspectives. You start meeting the people who love comic books just as much as you're going to love comic books. The people who play Magic the Gathering, and you're like, wait, I actually like this game, right? There's a softness that starts to settle in.
Robert Mueller, everybody calls me Bob. I'm part of the New Life program, which everybody keeps referring to as the reentry program. So we deal with the guys that are just about ready to go home. We also have a life, it's called a Life 2.0 simulation. It's a game, but it's really a financial responsibility simulation. So guys get a job on the wing. They might be the shoe store, they might be the gas station, they might be the grocery store, they might be the car salesman. And they actually sell cards that are the actual products. So shoes, you get a picture of shoes with a price on it. So for that job, you get paid a wage. You start out with a $15 an hour wage, and then that allows you then to pay your bills. So you have to have a place to live, you have to get a car, you got to get your driver's license. We had one of our coaches went home, and he did contact one of our guys that was still here, one of his friends that was another coach. He said, I didn't really appreciate at the time how much the simulation was helping me. And when I went home and now I have to pay my bills every month, if I didn't have that, he had been gone for 25, 26 years, something like that. And he would not have had the discipline. He goes, I would have forgotten about paying. As an educator, the biggest thing that you have to do is find out whether what you're doing is working. And we don't know right now. I mean, we think we're doing a good job. Guys like our program, seem to like our program, and when they leave, they're appreciative of the work that's been put in. But we don't have any concrete evidence the way we would like to.
Myself, I'm a coach on the reentry wing. I'm Antonio Jones. I have a group, parenting group, where I'll be going through parenting strategies and techniques and self-improvement and self-awareness techniques with a cognitive behavioral therapy approach as well as a trauma-informed approach. I had hidden resentment toward my father that I didn't realize prior to me actually engaging in his fatherhood course. Like, my father was very abusive and he was addicted to drugs from my infancy on up until my incarceration. And he actually passed away since I've been gone, so that makes it more a much more deeper conflict for me. There were several times when myself, I reached out for help to my educational providers and guidance counselors. I suffered abuse as a child and neglect, and I told literally to them, and my voice wasn't heard. And I believe if children reach out to you for help, you should reach back. And had they done that, it would have probably been a different trajectory for my life. I have a son that I don't know. I've never really met him since he was an infant, so that's something that's very difficult for me to grapple with and to come to terms with and to prepare myself to be able to re-enter society and hopefully reconnect with him. Because something that I advocate to every guy in my group specifically is that just because you're incarcerated, your role as a father doesn't stop.
That's Larry McCaskill, Robert Mueller, and Antonio Jones. They spoke with Emily Hayes. They've been in prison for around 2 decades for murder or sexual assault. Just ahead, the growing cost of food. That's on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Are you feeling you're not getting your money's worth these days, especially when it comes to food? Member station WBEZ takes a closer look.
Hi, I'm WBEZ producer Noah Jennings. Alongside the Chicago Sun-Times, we're gathering your questions about all things money and finances. Then each week, we get your questions answered by the people who know best. This week, we've got this question from Carson in Wilmette, who asks, why do I pay more for less? At restaurants, they make the portions look like it's the same, but when I open up the packaging, it's less. Everything is shrinking, and yet costs go up. Why? Well, it's a phenomenon called shrinkflation, and to find out more about it, we called up an expert.
I'm Edgar Dworsky. I'm the founder of ConsumerWorld.org, and I also run the website MousePrint.org. It looks at the fine print of advertising. I've been tracking shrinkflation for over 30 years. Well, restaurants as well as, you know, grocery stores are facing the same problem. They are paying more to buy the food that you're ultimately going to buy. They pay more for labor, they pay more for delivery, they pay more in tariffs and on certain things. And they all know that consumers are price sensitive. So if they raise the price substantially, that's going to turn off some number of consumers and shoppers. They certainly then think of the alternative. And the alternative is, well, maybe if we give the person a little bit less in the portion or less in the package, they won't notice it as readily. And sometimes, because inflation really is so high and tariffs are so high, you get both happening. You see the portion goes down and the price goes up. Most products we buy at the supermarket are not in see-through packages. So you can't see the boxes half empty. So you really have to get to know the net weight that you see on the package or the net count in terms of, you know, paper products, you know, how many sheets are on the roll, in terms of things that are weighed out, how many ounces in the package. And that has to be truthful. And if you get to know the net weight or net count, and you go back to the store the next time and see it's less, even though the package looks about the same, you are getting less. So in essence, you're paying more. Shrinkflation tends to come and go. When we're in periods of higher inflation, that means manufacturers and sellers, you know, are under more pressure because they're paying more and they have to figure out what to do about it. It will wane at times when prices start to go down and their costs start to go down. We won't have as many increases as we're seeing now. But over the last couple of years, because of rising prices, we see shrinking products and portions.
Edward Dworsky is founder of the website Consumer World. And thanks to WBEZ for that segment. It's that time of the year when people eat a lot of pumpkin, pumpkin pie, pumpkin bread, even pumpkin ice cream. Most of the pumpkin that goes into those treats comes from Morton, a town in central Illinois about 15 miles from Peoria. In fact, in any given year, up to 95% of the canned pumpkin in the U.S. comes from that area. In this Encore piece, first aired a year ago, contributor Joe Deacon gives us a look into how this popular crop figures into the local economy.
On a cool and breezy fall morning, John Ackerman surveys the pumpkin crop on his farm field just east of Morton.
It's been a good year for us. You know, normally pumpkins like it relatively dry. I've been amazed at how great this year was for pumpkins.
Ackerman's 30-acre farm has been in his family since 1909, originally focused on livestock, small grains, and row crops. In the 80s, he shifted the primary interest to pumpkins when he was first contracted by the nearby Libby's plant in Morton, a village that has embraced an identity as pumpkin capital of the world.
As soon as you start raising pumpkins, you fall in love with them. It's a great way of life.
Farms in this part of the country are well known for growing corn and soybeans. But in Morton and around Peoria, there's an emphasis on foods people serve during the holidays, especially pumpkins.
It's a great story to tell. You know, one of my colleagues once said, Thanksgiving is brought to you by Greater Peoria.
That's Chris Setti, the CEO of the Greater Peoria Economic Development Council. According to their figures, the Peoria region produces more than 220,000 tons of pumpkin each year. And a big reason for that is the Libby's plant. Rochelle Malin is with Nestle, Libby's parent company.
Over the last 16 years, we've harvested over 1.9 million tons of pumpkins. And then just last year, Libby's sold enough cans in grocery stores to bake over 48 million pumpkin pies.
Malin says more than 90% of Libby's pumpkins are grown within a 45-mile radius of the facility, allowing them to establish a partnership with their farmers through the entire process. She says they help growers identify the best fields for their pumpkins.
Then Nestle provides our proprietary pumpkin seed and offers technical assistance during the planting. Once the seeds are planted, the ag team works with growers to continuously monitor that soil health, climate, and our pumpkins throughout the growing season and harvest.
Malin says these unique partnerships allow them to explore more environmentally friendly practices, such as cover crops and precise fertilizer application to improve soil quality. And Illinois' soil and climate is ideal for growing pumpkins. Mohamed Babadoust is a professor of plant pathology at the University of Illinois who specializes in vegetable and fruit crops. He says pumpkins have a huge impact on the state's agricultural economy.
In Illinois, we grow at least three times more pumpkin than any other state. One time I calculated pumpkin industry in my calculation is over $200 million industry in Illinois.
In Morton, they're very aware that the town is the heart of that industry. The village holds an annual pumpkin festival, which attracts 75,000 people over 4 days each September. Mayor Jeff Kaufman says pumpkin is just about everything in Morton.
Next year, Libby's will be in Morton for 100 years. So it's very important. I mean, they have 200 employees when they're canning and everything, and they support our stores and shops, gas stations.
Kaufman says almost anywhere you look in Morton, you'll see some sort of pumpkin depiction.
Just painted our water tower. a new logo. And the very next day, I was already hearing compliments, and I had one lady demanded the other one get painted. I said, well, we're going to let the paint, you know, wear out just a little bit more.
Back at Ackerman's farm, they handpick roughly 30,000 pumpkins each year. For several weeks each fall, visitors flock to his farm stand to choose the perfect pumpkin from among 160 different varieties.
There's something iconically beautiful about looking over a pumpkin field when they're ripe, and it just shows the fruits of your labor.
As he looks out over his field of orange, white, and yellow pumpkins, Ackerman says the farm will continue to be a busy place as Thanksgiving approaches. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Joe Deacon. This holiday season, millions of Americans will be hosting Thanksgiving dinner. And in many households, one important question for guests: did you bring pumpkin pie or sweet potato pie? Chad Davis reports while both dishes are similar, they carry different histories.
Photos and memorabilia line the walls of Old Henry Restaurant in suburban St. Louis. It's one of those restaurants with a wall of pictures of local and national celebrities. And longtime customers come to the cafeteria for soul food staples like fish, mac and cheese, and greens. When it comes to Thanksgiving pie, owner Ada Joyce Taylor and her granddaughter Adriana Black have a definite opinion.
Potato pie. Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Sweet potato pie, because I'm looking for that sweetness in a pie.
The flaky crust contains a deep orange filling made from boiled and peeled sweet potatoes. In the weeks before Thanksgiving, executive chef Tracy Stevenson and other bakers are cranking out even more pies.
Number of week, I would say that we go through at least 15 to 20 sweet potato pies. During the holiday, I would say 40 to 50.
Millions of Americans will choose between sweet potato pie or pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving dessert. Both are American staples with a starchy custard-like filling. But pumpkin pie tends to be more spice-heavy than sweet, and sweet potato pie is typically sweeter and lighter. The reasons why people choose one over the other often trace back to where the person was raised and their race. Sweet potatoes may have resonated among enslaved people because they're somewhat similar to yams, grown in West Africa, according to soul food historian and James Beard Award-winning author Adrian Miller. But he says cooking the natively grown sweet potato in a pie, that's a more European food.
So it's really the expertise of these enslaved cooks making something unfamiliar to them to please their slaveholders that eventually gets embraced and adopted. It's the same with things like fried chicken, you know, barbecue and all these other things that were not necessarily part of the West African food heritage.
Since then, sweet potato pie has become a hallmark of Black cuisine and common on dinner tables across the South. But it's pumpkin pie that plays a central role in our portrait of the quintessential Thanksgiving dinner. The pie dates back to the colonial period, where settlers learned how to boil or steam native pumpkins and mash them into a filling. Bruce Craig is an Illinois-based culinary historian. He says a book from 1827 by author and activist Sarah Josepha Hale is largely responsible for the dessert's connection to Thanksgiving.
She said, pumpkin pie is the American pie from our founding fathers.
But he says Hale got it a bit wrong.
The pilgrims who came to New England brought this pie with them. They didn't. It's not true. But she said so. So it became the thing. It became the Yankee pie.
36 years later, Hale convinced President Abraham Lincoln to proclaim Thanksgiving as a national holiday. And pumpkin pie remains incredibly popular to this day. At the Blue Owl Bakery in House Springs, Missouri, owner Kim Byerly and an assembly line of bakers will create all kinds of pumpkin pie variations.
These are our pumpkin gooey butter cheesecakes. So they've got like a pumpkin spice crust on the bottom and then a pumpkin pie filling with the pumpkin mousse on top and whipped cream.
When restaurant bakers like Cindy Watu takes a bite of the pie, it takes her back to her childhood.
I'm partial to the spices that are in it. It's not like so sweet. And then it just reminds me of home, of family.
And for many across the country, that's why they stick with pumpkin or sweet potato pie, because of the memories they've made when they've eaten it. I'm Chad Davis.
Illinois' most popular state park is getting a makeover. Starved Rock State Park will undergo an $18 million improvement project over the next year. Repairs will be made to retaining walls, bridges, stairways, and boardwalks. The project will also address erosion that has occurred throughout the park. Todd Stroll is assistant director of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources.
Visitors might simply need to plan ahead and make sure that some of their plans are not impacted by the construction activity.
The park's website and Facebook page will be updated weekly during the repairs. Starved Rock attracts more than 2 million visitors each year. Seven Illinois members of Congress are urging the U.S. EPA to release billions of Biden-era dollars for lead pipe replacements. Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco has that story.
Lead pipes can dangerously contaminate drinking water, and Chicago leads the nation with the most lead pipes, over 400,000, pumping water into buildings across the city. So far, the city has replaced just over 14,000 pipes. Illinois Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy said the city is counting on federal support.
There's a lot of folks scratching their head. They've hired people to do the work, but the money isn't there to actually get the project started.
Federal rules require that the city replace all of its toxic pipes by 2047. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco, WBEZ News.
Next up, we report on a bid to clean up the Ohio River. The river begins in downtown Pittsburgh and flows past several states on its way to Cairo at the southern tip of Illinois. It's played a big role in American history and American industry. The Ohio was downriver of every Pittsburgh steel mill. It had other mills along its banks from Steubenville, Ohio to Ashland, Kentucky. Anything along the Tennessee River or the Wabash flows into the Ohio. And that leads to a question, how do you clean it up? A plan to scrub it would take support from Congress. Morgan Watkins with Louisville Public Media went out on the water.
A paddle along a small slice of the Ohio River in Louisville reveals the industrial history of this waterway. People call it a working river because it's an important pathway for barges, transporting millions of tons of cargo each year. One floats by, carrying freight past a family-owned sand company on the shore, one of many riverside businesses. The booming of industry along the Ohio River has boosted the economies of many waterfront towns, but it also took an environmental toll. Forrest Clevenger is paddling the canoe. He leads a nonprofit called the Ohio River Way. He's excited about an idea to protect the wetlands, rivers, and streams that make up the entire Ohio River basin through investments in
clean water, habitat restoration, flooding mitigation, and public recreational infrastructure.
It's a big vision, but he says it's not unique.
Like restoration initiatives that are in watersheds all around the country, just not here.
He's talking about restoration programs launched for historic American waters in recent decades, like the Great Lakes, Chesapeake Bay, and the Everglades. In all of them, the federal government has been providing substantial funding and coordinating partnerships with states and local communities. Now, after several years of work, people in this region have a blueprint to take to Congress. It's called the Ohio River Basin Restoration and Protection Plan. Last month, the groups behind the plan co-hosted a special conference in Louisville. Chris Lorenz chairs one of them, the Ohio River Basin Alliance.
This is a game changer, a once-in-a-lifetime, once-in-a-generation opportunity. We're asking for this now, and we're going to show that it's worth the investment.
What they're asking for is money from Congress, an initial investment of $350 million per year for 5 years. The funds could help do things like clean up contaminated sites and update public water systems along the river. The plan's supporters say repairing the region's environmental health will boost local tourism and economies. That's why Lorenz has high hopes Congress and President Trump will fund it.
When you look at the priorities of any administration, including the current one, it's economic development, it's community enhancement.
While their plan focuses a lot on restoring the environment, he says it checks those economic boxes too. Democratic Congressman Morgan McGarvey of Louisville is working on bipartisan legislation to launch the Ohio River Restoration Initiative.
The Ohio River is the largest body of water in the entire country that does not receive a single dollar in dedicated federal funding. Not one. That's something we got to change.
He acknowledges getting Congress's approval won't happen easily or quickly.
We will never stop fighting because I think this is the type of legacy generational product where I hope 50, 60, 70, 100 years from now, nobody knows who did it, but they love and stand in awe and in wonder of the incredible Ohio River and the Ohio River Valley.
Supporters know it's an uphill battle, But after years of work building a coalition across 14 states and hundreds of communities that make up the Ohio River Basin, they finally have a detailed plan to show Congress what is possible with their support. For NPR News, I'm Morgan Watkins in Louisville.
More to come on Statewide. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The state of Iowa has the lowest number of OBGYNs per capita in the country. Lawmakers there want to change that, but many experts say the state's strict abortion ban is the problem. Natalie Krebs reports.
Dr. Carla Solheim leads the Iowa chapter of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She says practicing got harder after Iowa's abortion ban started in 2024.
It just feels like our job is impossible.
Solheim says a recent pregnant patient developed life-threatening complications, so Solheim ended the pregnancy. She says afterwards she was grilled by hospital administrators to make sure the abortion qualified for an exception under the law.
Did I have enough evidence? Was her blood count low enough that her life was in danger? Should we have waited until her blood pressure got lower to proceed with terminating the pregnancy?
Another OBGYN, Jonna Quinn, ended up leaving Iowa. Quinn grew up here and really wanted to stay, but the problems and stresses kept building at her job. For one thing, she worked at a Catholic hospital that did not allow her to offer all the birth control options or fertility treatments. And the staffing shortages kept getting worse. Quinn says at one point she was seeing up to 50 patients a day.
That is twice what a normal OBGYN will see in a day. I knew I was going to miss something because there's no way somebody can function at that level.
But the final straw came when Iowa lawmakers banned most abortions after 6 weeks. Quinn says she felt like she was working under too many restrictions to provide the best medical care.
I could either stay and ruin myself and my career and my mental health and my relationship with my children, or I could go and continue to practice OB, which had always been my dream.
Last year, Quinn took a job in Minnesota, where the state constitution protects abortion. In Iowa, lawmakers are trying to keep OBs and attract even more. They raise the amount that Medicaid pays doctors for maternity care. They also used $150 million to create more residency training slots across Iowa. Solheim says these things help, but the state's abortion law is an issue for OBGYNs.
They understandably do not want to put their licenses and their livelihood at risk when it comes to taking care of patients.
It's still unclear how state abortion bans affect OBs. A national study of federal data didn't find OBGYNs are leaving abortion ban states in significant numbers. Some researchers say the laws are so new, it's too soon to see an effect. But when it comes to medical students, the future doctors, these laws do seem to be having an impact. Applications for medical residencies have dropped in states with abortion bans. That's especially true for OBGYN residencies. That's according to the Association of American Medical Colleges. E is in her final year of medical school in Iowa, and she wants to be an OBGYN.
I really worry about the effect that abortion bans will have on my future patients and on my ability to provide evidence-based care for my patients.
E asked to be identified by her middle initial because she's concerned her comments could negatively affect her future career.
The idea of leaving Iowa possibly forever breaks my heart, but it is something I'm seriously considering at this point.
For NPR News, I'm Natalie Krebs in Des Moines.
It took more than 30 years to bring 110-mile-per-hour passenger train service from Chicago to St. Louis. It could take that or longer to get true high-speed rail along the same corridor. Charlie Schlinker examines the way forward.
This is progress. New means of serving people better at lower cost per ton mile.
Imagine passengers going from Chicago to East St. Louis in about 2.5 hours. Or Chicago to Bloomington Normal, Bloomington Normal to East St. Louis, or say Chicago to Champaign-Urbana, each in an hour and change. Those are huge savings in driving time, never envisioned by the makers of this 1951 film, Boosting Freight Railroads.
Railroads mean many things to the people of Illinois, and to thousands of our people today, they mean jobs.
The Illinois High-Speed Rail Commission, supported by the Illinois Department of Transportation, is studying the possibility of high-speed rail along the Chicago to St. Louis corridor. There are several possible alignments. One skips Bloomington Normal and goes to Champaign-Urbana, Decatur, and then Springfield. Another goes from Chicago to Peoria and then to Springfield. All the possibilities would use dedicated track, no stops outside major cities, and complete separation of grade crossings and crossovers. Chris Coos, the mayor of Normal, sits on the board of Amtrak.
The multiple billions of dollars that it would take to do a high-speed rail line, regardless of the alignment, is pretty daunting and, you know, a 15 to 20 year project.
18 other countries do high-speed rail quite well. Former U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says, for instance, China, Japan, and Italy all have 200-mile-an-hour trunk lines fed by lower-speed rail routes, and all have direct, robust support of national governments, not just state governments.
Without that kind of vision, and without that kind of financial commitment, we are way, way behind in America.
During the Obama administration, the nation took its first $8 billion step toward high-speed rail. $4-plus billion went to California, which LaHood says has doubled that investment in the succeeding 20 years. Dallas to Houston is getting ready to go, LaHood says, and the Trump administration could find plenty of private dollars if it wanted to commit to it. Amtrak board member Chris Coos says the current administration pulled the plug on that study. In Nevada, the Biden administration plunked down $3 billion on the Las Vegas to L.A. route.
So the initiative that was started by President Obama with his vision for passenger rail is moving along, not as quickly as we'd all would like, but it's happening in America.
And even though the San Francisco to L.A. effort under construction is way over budget and taking too long, LaHood says it will also be a win. Okay, back to Chicago to East St. Louis. The study will take a while. Mayor Chris Coos has doubts.
I see it to be visionary, but I don't see the economics of it working.
He says the amount of land acquisition would be incredibly high for a green grass route.
It'll be interesting to see what a private organization, Brightline, is trying to do in California, where they're trying to leverage existing land along an interstate. And if that works, that may be a solution. Then it really narrowly defines a corridor.
Part of the Illinois study does consider using highway right-of-way and even county road right-of-way in some spots. Consultant Charles Quandel says it will also be important to use electric propulsion, like the Japanese Shinkansen bullet train, instead of the engines Amtrak currently uses. The rate of acceleration, Quandel says, is faster with electric.
Current Amtrak equipment that's diesel-powered, it takes about 4 miles at its top speed. In contrast with the catenary electric propulsion, they're able to hit that same speed in just about a mile.
The current Chicago to St. Louis corridor through Bloomington Normal already helps passengers who would rather not drive that distance. Joe Szabo, a former head of the Federal Railroad Administration, says the competition is different for 220-mile-an-hour service.
In 220, what you're looking to do is to be superior to air.
Szabo believes in a passenger rail program in which you connect 220 service from major markets with minimal stops to a 110-mile-an-hour regional network and feeder lines into that network that travel at a traditional 79 miles an hour. And understanding how the aviation market connects, he says, is important. Szabo says 220-mile-an-hour service can be used to shift passenger demand to rail.
When you're talking about a distance of 500-600 miles, that's kind of the sweet spot for 220-mile-an-hour service. And it frees up that capacity in the aviation network for the longer-distance flights, which are much more efficient, you know, in the longer distance.
It's possible the airline industry might not see it that way. The ongoing Illinois High-Speed Rail Commission study is trying to gauge whether people want 220 service by doing a variety of surveys online and in person. Rhett Fussell is a transportation engineer with a consulting firm, WSP. Fussell spoke at the commission meeting in May.
O'Hare and Midway, those both agencies refused, the airport lawyers refused to allow us to do surveys on the airport property. And so did St. Louis.
The commission does have more than 6,000 responses to surveys. Illinois Department of Transportation Transit Planning Manager Hannah Martin says comments are mostly positive so far.
We've got a lot of support coming in for the route to include the Champaign-Urbana area. We've also had some support. You folks have mentioned Decatur and Peoria. There are comments saying, you know, make sure that this is efficient when you talk about a feeder network. Train to train is better than train to bus.
There are other ways to get at the question of market demand, studying population, strength of local economies, how those economies complement each other in business and industry, and how they connect to each other via air. That all factors into the choice of where to put 220 service. Amtrak board member Chris Koo says, let's wait and see because the economic studies have not yet been done. Both Coos and former Federal Railroad Administration head Joe Szabo suspect that on the surface, Chicago to Minneapolis might be a better fit for the first true high-speed rail line in the Midwest. Szabo says Minneapolis is a stronger population center than St. Louis, and it may be a better fit with Chicago. Szabo says it will be important to make sure nobody tries to put their thumb on the scale in generating those studies.
That's kind of the million-dollar question, isn't it? Because you really do want to try to make certain that you have, you know, an honest assessment that is being based on population and economies.
The cities of Champaign-Urbana, Decatur, and Peoria are all very interested in having a stop on the potential 220 service route. One government official says, get your popcorn and settle in to watch the politics happen. Joe Szabo says the answer to political infighting is to make sure everyone knows they won't be left behind.
Everybody wants the big prize, but perhaps they're not the best example for the big prize, right? But that doesn't mean that they should be left alone and left isolated. It comes back to this interconnected network to make sure that the citizens of all these communities have quality connectivity to the broader system.
Szabo says in order to really show that ridership is going to be there for 220 service between Chicago and East St. Louis, it's going to be important to continue to grow ridership on the existing 110-mile-an-hour service.
Charlie Schlinker with that report. Former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says whenever high-speed rail happens, it will have to be a public-private partnership because of the expense. Several locations in McDonough County in western Illinois were stops on the Underground Railroad. A new mural at Macomb's Railroad Station pays tribute to the compassionate souls who lived there and the courageous freedom seekers who passed through the area. Here's Rich Egger.
An excited, standing-room-only crowd filled the lobby at the Thomas C. Carper Amtrak station in anticipation of the mural unveiling. After a brief presentation, the black drapes covering the three panels of the mural were removed. The artwork received immediate approval. Artist Michael Mahoney says he wanted to humanize freedom seekers by showing real people with expressions on their faces.
There's a sense of determination as well as fear.
An image of a broken chain across the mural symbolizes breaking away from the bonds of slavery. Mahoney says it took a lot of courage to escape slavery and seek freedom.
They didn't know what was going to be there, who was going to be there, what might happen along the way. Wow, that's tough.
Mahoney believes the Underground Railroad mural ties into the mural he painted of civil rights leader, the Reverend Dr. C.T. Vivian. That mural is just a block away from the new one. He says freedom seekers and Vivian both fought for freedom and civil rights. The mural also highlights the rural homes of the Ellison and Blazer families. Brenda Ellison of Macomb says it's a proud moment for her family to have the Ellison farm depicted in the mural. She says her ancestors faced pushback from those who supported slavery.
They didn't want them to vote.
So they had to come to town with guns blazing. So I'm from a really rebel activism type family.
Allison wishes she knew more about what her ancestors did, but Underground Railroad conductors were secretive. They were breaking the law, so they did not keep journals about their activities. But now, their contributions in helping others escape the injustice of slavery are celebrated in a very public piece of art in downtown Macomb. Rich Egger reporting.
We're out of time for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us again next week. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.